Our next case is Nadeem versus State of Nebraska. We'll wait just one moment for them to exit. Right, again, this case is Nadeem versus State of Nebraska. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jeff Patterson. I'm here on behalf of Mohammed Nadeem. This is an appeal from a Rule 12b-6 dismissal of Mohammed's complaint, a complaint that was filed pursuant to the Nebraska Claims for Wrongful Conviction and Imprisonment Act. Standard review for this Court is de novo, accepting as true all well-pled facts and the proper and reasonable inference of law and fact which may be drawn from the complaint. I don't believe that there is really a dispute that the complaint addresses all of the elements in the Wrongful Conviction Act in order to recover. I think what is at issue are competing inference that are derived from prior opinions of this Court, panels of this Court. And it's generally true in wrongful conviction cases that there is going to be a prior appellate opinion. That's why you discover it's a wrongful conviction. And in this case, there are three opinions from this Court, one of which is withdrawn. The panel was the same on each occasion. Judge Pirtle was on all three panels. And then there is one opinion from our Supreme Court. And generally, in a Rule 12b-6 complaint, you look at the complaint and only at the complaint to see whether it states a claim.
Let me stop you there. I don't disagree with what you just said, but is the Court not also able to take judicial notice of either its own prior decisions or appellate court decisions that involve the same parties and the same issues?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, at the hearing, it was just a 10-minute hearing. In fact, I didn't even look at the exception. But the state offered the prior opinions into evidence. I objected only because the nature of the hearing.
So we normally don't look outside the pleadings, but at least you can take judicial notice of prior opinions or appellate opinions, and that still leaves it within a motion to dismiss as opposed to turning it into a motion for summary judgment.
It certainly does, but the caveat to that is that the prior opinions or the public record can only be read to the extent that it doesn't contradict them. And that's, I think, where I part company with the district court.
To survive a motion to dismiss, doesn't your client have to be able to plead actual innocence, not just legal innocence?
Yeah, and we did. I think it was in the second paragraph. He said, I'm actually innocent.
Is that enough for a party to simply say? Let's say your client went to trial. He did, actually, and he was convicted.
Right.
There were some procedural errors or inefficient assistance of counsel that this Court decided later. But let's say your client was acquitted. Does that make him innocent?
No.
Makes him not guilty.
No, but you're right. And particularly in this setting, not only does he have the burden to prove his actual innocence, but he has the burden to prove that by clear and convincing evidence. This is not my first wrongful conviction case, and that is a steep burden, steep hill to climb.
Actual innocence would be, that wasn't even me, you have the wrong party, something like that, right? Not just, my conviction got reversed.
Or in this case, there was never a crime that occurred, and that's what is pled in the complaint. On August 6th, which was the day that... the day that Mohammed had this conversation with HK in the library, by this Court's opinion, it was just an objectively innocent conversation, nothing sexual about it whatsoever. For some reason or another, the next day, Lincoln Police got involved and decided that they were going to do what they call a controlled call. And in this controlled call, HK, the girl, was directed by Lincoln Police as to what to say it, how to respond to Mohammed in order to induce him into making statements that could be used then to infer his intent. And that's, again, what this Court said in prior opinions is that the call actually showed that HK was the aggressor. She was always the one that brought up sexual content, always the one that suggested sexual content. that Mohammed's response showed hesitance, confusion, and that he may not have even known what the word intercourse meant.
If we took the entrapment issue out of this, if the girl made the call on her own, are we here discussing wrongful conviction?
I don't know how we would have anything if the girl made the call on her own. It's only through the police involvement that this even happened.
But if we just took that out, this went to trial as it did.
No.
He was convicted.
Dirty talk on the telephone is not the same as third-degree sexual assault.
Well, but they arranged to meet. Is that not a substantial step?
In a public library. And I'm not aware of anywhere in Isley Library where people go to have sex. It's patently ridiculous to think that you are going, that a substantial step in having a sexual assault or sexual conduct is to go to a public
library. So that was where they met. So what you're saying is you have to wait and allow them to get to a more private place before it becomes a substantial step?
There isn't a substantial step when they're in the library. First of all, we don't know what Mohammed was thinking because he didn't testify at the criminal trial. He has not had the opportunity to tell you or tell a jury or tell a judge what he was thinking. It's equally as plausible.
We know what he was thinking based on what he said in the phone call, don't we?
We know how he responded to Lincoln Police's inducement.
I mean, he indicated what he wanted to do or would do, didn't he?
No. That is, again, the inferences go to him, go to the pleading. He did not indicate he was responding to what he was induced into saying.
He knew she was, she said she was 15. She wasn't even 15, as I recall. He knew that his knowledge was she was 15. He was 22.
Right. The person he was talking to was supposedly someone who he gave a slip of paper to, saying his name was John Nadim.
He wanted to connect with her.
The person who called him said Mohammed. Now, how was this person he gave a name, John, to supposed to know that his name is Mohammed? There was a question in Mohammed's name. Mind from the very start, who is this person? There is no proof that he even knew who this person was.
Yet he met her at the library.
He was curious as to what was going on. That's the inference that can be derived from that.
Well, clearly a jury determined there were other inferences that could be derived from that.
The jury did, and the jury also had a numbered jury where their identity was not disclosed to Mohammed. Clearly indicating to the jury that someone named Mohammed is a threat to them if they knew his name. Frankly, just grossly incompetent defense counsel that didn't object to what were obvious errors. And from that, and then a very, very good prosecutor, I happen to know personally, he's a friend of mine, and a conviction arose from that. This court thought that the conviction was improper.
At this stage, you're just saying you've set out enough in the pleadings to beat the motion. Is that correct?
Exactly.
We're not talking about what you're going to have to prove or how this may end up down the road. This is, you just think you had set out enough in your pleading to get by a motion to dismiss, and this ought to move forward.
That's exactly right. And I would note to you in the other case I tried in this, it was Page County, and Judge Bryan down there just wrote in at least two summary judgment motions that he overruled, that we had a very steep hill to climb, the burden was against us, he doesn't see how we're going to prove our case. But yet when we had the opportunity to prove our case, and I think that's the nature of these kind of cases. There's an original conviction that really is sustained. We have then a difficult burden to overcome that. We can't do that unless we're given the opportunity to take depositions, develop a record.
I just want to ask you one more thing. When in our prior opinion we said that there appeared to be enough evidence to retry him, does that present a barrier to you in this situation?
In any reversal, there's always enough evidence, not always, but there generally is enough evidence to retry them. That's because all of the inadmissible evidence is considered. And it's all considered in the state's favor. Trial. In this case, it's although the complaint is construed most favorably, essentially, to the complaining party in this case, and so the burdens are so opposite.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further? Thank you. May it please the court, the district court properly dismissed Nadeem's complaint because Nadeem did not plead facts supporting a claim of actual innocence. Just heard 10 minutes ago a concession that if you take entrapment out of this, he has no case. Same thing the district judge found.
This is, we're a notice pleading state, correct?
Correct.
So all the plaintiff has to do is put enough in a complaint to let the defendant know what he or she is alleging, what the cause of action is. Not every fact has to be pleaded anymore. They don't have to prove their case in the complaint. They simply have to put enough information in there so that the defendant knows what the nature of the case is and where it's headed. Is that fair?
That's a fair assessment, but there's one thing that Nadeem wants to leave out here, and that's the next element in a case that sets this out great is Central Nebraska Public Power versus North Platte, 280 Nebraska 533. And that element that gets left off of the standard review on occasion is the one that says you can't just recite an element of a cause of action in a conclusory statement and then call it good enough. You need further factual enhancement. That's what we have here. It's Nadeem's burden to plead these facts showing both legal and actual innocence. He has a very lengthy complaint about legal innocence, but where are the facts about actual innocence? Ultimately, he's claiming that he's actually innocent because he's trapped, but as we learned from the Hess case, that's just legal innocence. We didn't hear a single fact today that, you know, here's paragraph whatever that shows here's his complaint, or here's his pleading showing actual innocence. Instead, you heard a number of things that are not in the complaint and how they want to take judicial notice of the Court of Appeals' prior opinions. Another case...
Well, if we did that, this court has already held there was sufficient evidence, so there can't be actual innocence.
That's correct, case. And that gets to the point from Hess, which is actual innocence is defined as the absence of facts that are prerequisites for the sentence given. And this court has already said there were at least some facts, maybe not enough to convict him, but there were some facts. And if there were some facts, then that means there cannot be the absence of facts.
Why didn't the state retry him?
I don't have a specific answer to that question. The Nadeem 3 alludes to why that may be, because
his
he had already
time
served.
Was done.
Because his time was done, right.
Yeah.
So let's say you did retry it, and a jury found him innocent. That could
happen. No, they don't find him innocent, though, right?
Nope.
Not guilty.
I'm sorry. That was a bad choice.
Yeah.
Let's say you retried him, and the verdict comes back not guilty. That could have happened, notwithstanding what we had said in our prior opinion. So what we said in our prior opinion isn't really a res judicata on the issue, correct?
I'll say that's correct. I mean, there's kind of two parts to it here, right? So if he wants to rely on that opinion, I think it's entirely fair that we can also rely on that opinion. But ultimately, it comes down to what's in his complaint. That's what's missing. There are not facts supporting the claim of actual
innocence. Well, then can he amend? Can he file an amended petition and cure that?
He didn't ask to, and he didn't assign it as error.
Is that plain error?
I don't believe so. And another case I want to bring to light, we just found it before appearing today, and so it's not in our briefs, but it's Rodriguez versus Nielsen, 264 Nebraska, 558. And it's a legal malpractice case, so you're going to think, well, it's not the same. But the question there was whether or not the plaintiff had pled actual innocence, showing facts. And there they had a much more developed factual pleading than we have here. But the Supreme Court said, that the plaintiff was required to plead facts showing actual innocence, but instead of pleading that they didn't commit the acts that occurred or they weren't there or anything like was mentioned previously, the plaintiff just tried to justify her actions. That's basically what we have here. We don't have any facts saying I wasn't there or I never formed any of, you know, I didn't say that on the phone call, that wasn't me, anything like that. Instead we have I was entrapped. Well, maybe. But that's only for element 2 of the Wrongful Conviction Act, and he didn't plead anything on element 1. So that's fundamentally the problem we have here.
The case you cited earlier, I didn't see in your brief. Could you give me that cite again to that?
Sure. Central Nebraska Public Power versus North Platte. It's 280 Nebraska 533. It came out at the same time as the Doe case. It's reciting the principle after the Twombly and Iqbal cases in the U.S. Supreme Court. And sometimes what we see is, even on the litigant side of things, we don't quote the entire principle for you in the standard of review. And so that case lays it all out, and that's why I'm providing that one for you.
Thank you.
Our brief here didn't lay out all of the factors, and so I wanted to provide you the appropriate standard.
It seems like Mr. Patterson's been arguing that, you know, there was never a crime, so it's sort of you'd never be able to meet your burden of proof as a state. I feel like it's sort of saying, if we did try this case, we would be able to beat it and have my client acquitted because you can't meet the elements, there was no substantial step, and that's an issue for a jury to decide as opposed to a court deciding actual innocence. It gets a little twisted.
And you're on to what they're saying, which is he has the burden upside down. They keep talking about how we can't prove our case, and maybe we can't. I don't know. We're not trying to retry him here. All we're saying is it's his burden to plead these facts, and can't just block quote portions of an opinion about entrapment without providing some actual innocence facts. That's where we're at.
So the entrapment issue may be a basis to say there's legal innocence, right?
Sure.
Right, but it doesn't suffice for actual innocence.
Correct. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the dismissal by the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does this?
How much time is Mr. Patterson? Thank you.
Entrapment is really a red herring in this whole thing. It's the inducement that is important. It's the inducement of that phone call. That phone call doesn't reflect Mohammed's state of mind. I mean, after all, this is only a state of mind offense. It's his intent as derived from that phone call and then showing up at the library. Talking with the girl on August 6th was not a crime. Dirty talk on a telephone is not a crime. Going to a public place to meet whoever it was talking to you on the phone is not a crime. It's only what you suppose was in his mind. And to say that because there was... May I finish?
Yes, please.
Say that because one time there was a conviction, you can never prove actual innocence, absolutely destroys the wrongful conviction act.
You've proven otherwise.
There is no cause of action at all. So, and that's been their argument all. That's been the state's argument all. There are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, the matter is submitted. You're excused. The next case is Bilderbeck-Vess versus Vess.